Montino Institute was a rather unique institution in many different ways. Its history began with an American named Nuttall, who had gone to Cambridge as a biologist and developed into one of the world's leading parasitologists and stayed in England. This was the migration of that period, turn of the century. Nuttall was a pioneer immunologist and parasitologist. One of Cecil Rhodes's partners, a gentleman named Maltino, South African, made a fortune in South Africa and came to England to establish his credentials as a donor, as a benefactor, and I suppose aspire to the now upper classes of England. One of the ways then and now in which this was done was to be a very generous benefactor of something important. Mr. Maltino gave the money to build a brand new institute for Nuttall. It was called the Maltino Institute for the Study of Parasitology. Parasites being very important in Africa, Maltino did his thing. Other South Africans of the period, like Cecil Rhodes, endowed the Rhodes Scholarships. Alfred Beit, another one of the pioneer millionaires of Africa, endowed the Beit Fellowships of England, which were very important in postdoctoral training in science, and particularly in the biological sciences. During the First World War, the big parasite problem was the louse and typhus because of the trench warfare in France and elsewhere. The leading young parasitologist of France was a Polish emigre named David Kalin, whom Nuttall induced to come to England and work in his laboratory. And when Nuttall retired, Kalin became the Quick Professor of Biology and the director of the Maltino Institute. And it was in the early 1920s, when Kalin was studying parasites, that he discovered cytochromes and recognized what these were, and then proceeded to maintain a dual life. On the one hand, he became a biochemist, self-taught, working in the field of cytochromes and oxidation reduction enzymes. On the other hand, one whole floor of the Maltino Institute remained devoted to parasitology. And he continued to edit the periodical Parasitology until the day he died, having succeeded Nuttall in this periodical that was published by the Cambridge University Press from the Maltino Institute. Kalin was a warm, wonderful, friendly human being. So was his wife. And we became very close and intimate friends. He was a man of broad culture and education. Grew up in Russian Poland. Actually born in Moscow, but his family was exiled, kicked out of Moscow to go live in Poland, where he got his education and grew up, and went off to study in Paris, philosophy. And as Kalin told the story, which is now an old story because it's repeated, he was caught in a rainstorm and went into the nearest lecture hall and listened to a lecture in biology and found that the most thrilling thing he had ever heard. And became a biologist. There are some things to be said for the relaxed, laissez-faire form of European education, where you could go to any school you wanted, do anything you wanted. Eventually you pass some exams in the field, but attend lectures, not attend lectures. And he became, took his bachelor's degree and his PhD in the field of parasitology. and became one of the world's most distinguished parasitologists. So Kaelin was attracting two kinds of people, downstairs parasitologists and upstairs biochemists, the man who was isolating the cytochromes and studying their importance in cellular respiration, studying other heme enzymes, and isolating other enzymes of importance in biological oxidations. And it was a rather unique group of people. At the time I was there, I was the only American. And it was a very, what turned out to be an exceedingly distinguished group of people. His principal long-term assistant, E.F. Hawtrey, or Ted Hawtrey, worked with Kaelin pretty much on the cytochromes, but also on other problems. Tadeusz Mann had come from Poland and worked with Kaelin on other enzymes and discovered a whole group of copper enzymes, including the polyphenol oxidases and whatnot, and discovered the zinc enzyme, the first zinc enzyme called carbonic anhydrase. Hans Lauser was an emigre from Germany who had come from Meyerhof's laboratory and was working on some aspects of cellular respiration. And most important from my viewpoint, F.B. Straub, or Bruno Straub, had come from St. George's Laboratory in Szeged, Hungary. Straub was a year younger than I, and we became very bosom friends very quickly. And Straub went back to Hungary in 1939 and retired last year as president of Hungary. He was the transition president. He was the non-party, non-political man who presided over the country during its transition period. Close, intimate friend. But made very many distinguished and important contributions in the field of biochemistry. Both before the war, he crystallized the first dehydrogenase, lactic dehydrogenase. He isolated flavine adenine dinucleotide independently of Warburg in the same year. Subsequently, he discovered actomyosin and the actin in myosin in St. George's lab after he went back to Hungary, and a whole series of other important discoveries. He became one of the leading figures in the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, still is, but I don't think he's an officer any longer. And as I said, he was picked as the neutral figure, respected, distinguished scientist, apolitical, very patriotic, to preside over the change from Hungary the dictatorship to Hungary the democracy, if you want to put it in simple terms. Who else was in the lab at that time? Carl Gustav Holmberg from Lund, Sweden, who worked on uricase, discovered that this was a copper enzyme. Jan Jankjes from Holland, went back to Holland as professor of pediatrics later, very distinguished pediatric scientist and nutritionist. And I think that's about it. All very intimate, all very friendly. The Kaelins were exceedingly hospitable people who arranged to see that all their foreign guests got to know each other, entertained them, got them acquainted with the Cambridge Society. Kaelin used to dine in college whenever there was a feast or a special meeting. He would bring one member of the lab with him as his guest. Every feast I can remember going to several with him at Magdalen College, which was his college, the College of Samuel Pepys. And we became acquainted very quickly with a whole generation of the young people over in the biochemistry department. And Hopkins was unique. He had a department of 15 or 20 postdoctoral or advanced postdoctorals and faculty members, each of whom worked on his own problems. Bacteria, plants, animals, didn't make any difference. It was all biochemistry. And a very different kind of biochemistry than existed anywhere else in the world at that time, partly because of Hopkins' benevolence and encouraging people to find their own interests and develop them, and partly because the breadth of view, that even though they taught medical students, that was only a small part of it. This was a university department. So that Peary was working on plant viruses, Marjorie Stevenson was working on bacterial metabolism, and so on and so forth. I don't have this history been described many times. It was a very exciting place to be. And the excitement, of course, was that we had to listen to the radio 10 times a day to find out whether war was starting yet. This was a grim period. We arrived in Cambridge a few weeks before Berchtesgaden and a month before Munich. So we unpacked, we settled down, and I said, I'm not moving until I have to move and get to work. But a lot of time was wasted in talking about what was going on. In retrospect, we didn't accomplish anything except that we learned something about each other. And we became very good friends. But as a place to learn biochemical science, it couldn't have been a better place in the world as far as I was concerned.
You had planned to go on to work with Meyerhoff.
That's right.
In your second year.
But in 1939, my brother and his wife had come over for summer vacation because they figured that they wanted to get to see Europe before the war started. They came to Cambridge, and we had a car. And we drove from Cambridge to London, and from London to Dover, and from Dover to Calais. And we drove around France for about several weeks. And the war clouds were gathering in Paris. We came back to England. My brother and his wife went home. And on the first, we were back in Cambridge on the 29th or 30th of September. Of August. We had been in Paris up to that time. And everybody was scurrying off the continent to get back to England. And we had a car, which we weren't going to abandon. And there was no sense in trying to get back because the people were sleeping on the beaches at Calais waiting to get on the ferry to go back to England. The British were spending their summer holidays all over the continent. And as soon as we found out that the coast was clear, we left Paris and drove back to Calais and got on the ferry and went across. My brother and his wife went to London and got book passage home. We went back to Cambridge. And on the 1st of September, Hitler invaded Poland. And on the 3rd, Chamberlain gave his speech to the nation on a Sunday night and declared war on Germany. And the next morning we came to the lab and Kalin told me that the plans had been in effect for some time, but laboratories were going to be evacuated from London and they were going to be in Molteno Institute and they were going on a war footing. All normal war research would basically stop it. I wanted to stay, I was welcome, but they would not be able to talk about what they were doing. I was an enemy, an alien, but a neutral alien. But nevertheless, this was war work, and if I wanted to stay, I could. If not, it would probably be better if I found a place to go. Well, I had planned to go to Meyerhof sometime around December. I was going to finish up what I had been doing with the chlorophyll protein complex and then go to learn something about intermediary metabolism with Meyerhof in Paris. By then, Meyerhof was on the way to the United States. Very shortly.
Well, then you came back.
So I came back and spent several months at Columbia, where I knew I had the spectrophotometer and the equipment to finish up what I had been doing, and where I could start writing the papers as well, get things done. Hecht offered me the hospitality and the use of secretary and whatnot. My wife went back to her teaching job in New York. And then, casting around for a place to go, I decided that a plant protein laboratory might be the right place. So I went to work with H.B. Vickery in New Haven.
When you reached that short period of Columbia, though, you did work with Pickles again.
That's right. And that's when we did the sedimentation right. work. But that was basically one day a week, or at most 2 days a week.
What kind of a person was he?
Ed Pickles, a gentlemanly, lively, entertaining Virginian. Strong southern accent, brutal and good relaxed attitude, at the same time a brilliant engineer. And he became unhappy at the Rockefeller, of course, in the later years of the war, because he was interested in creating new instruments. But the attitude of the virologist that he was working with, well, you've now made an instrument that works, just make us another one. They didn't want any new experiments as to how to build instruments. That was not their interest. And he collaborated a great deal of the virus work, but as soon as the war was over, he already had plans in his head, not for an improved air-driven ultracentrifuge, but for an electrically driven ultracentrifuge, which is what he designed out at Spinco, and not just the analytical machine, but the preparative machine as well. And I have been in touch with him in 1946 when I was going out to Utah. And we had gone out to Utah first, and we had just bought a house but were still living in a motel waiting to move in, and had been in Salt Lake all of 4 or 5 days when Pickles and his wife came through and stopped at the same motel to see us. We had dinner together, we started to talk, and he told me all about the plans of Spinco and what he was going to do. I said, look, I don't know where I'll get the money, but I want the first machine. Analytical ultracentrifuge. He says, you can't have the first machine because I stopped in Ann Arbor to see Tommy Francis, and he's already ordered number one, so you'll get number two. That's how you start a company. And as soon as he wrote to say they had was well underway and that the prototype was working, we talked about it, and we managed to find the money. We got the money out of the NIH. And Ed came himself to install the machine.
What was the arrangement that you had in New Haven? Vickery was at the Ag Experiments.
Well, I was finishing up the second year of my Guggenheim fellowship. And what I wanted to learn from Vic was, you know, how to prepare proteins, classical stuff, and how to do some amino acid analysis. I think partly what was in my mind was also the fact that I needed a contact with somebody in American biochemistry to begin to think about what the hell I was going to do in the future. And then Vic was giving lectures in the history of protein chemistry once a week down in the biochemistry department at the medical school. And this was late afternoon, and of course I would quit same time he did, go down and listen to his lectures. Usually it was about a 2-hour session. Rather than giving 2 1-hour lectures a week, he gave a 2-hour lecture each time, which was wonderful because I learned a lot about the history of protein chemistry. But then I met other people in the department through Vickery, and one of the people I met was Abe White. And then after I had done some gravimetric amino acid analysis and learned how to do proper Kaldol nitrogens and proper sulfur analysis the way he wanted them done, I had been doing some Kaldols long before anyhow, there wasn't even a good colorimeter in the agricultural experiment station. Everything there was gravimetric. That was Vic. It changed later years, but everything at that time, we're talking about 1939, everything was gravimetric. They're 40, spring of 40. But Abe White has some good colorimeters, and in addition to studying these family of plant proteins and doing arginine analysis, I also did tyrosine, tryptophanes, and cysteine using colorimetric analysis in Abe White's lab. So that was the connection. But formally, I was in Vic's lab during that period. We'd go down to the medical school once or twice a week in the last period that I was there.
Well, I want to talk about White later on in connection with
the principles.
The principle book, but we can touch that as a separate issue later on. Rockefeller, how did you make that connection?
Well, the connection was made there in a very, very simple way. I was looking for a job. I was on my second year as a Guggenheim Fellow, and I was looking for a job. I was a half-breed, or a quarter-breed. I wasn't the proper kind of biochemist for a job in a medical school, because I'd never been to medical school. I didn't have the kind of formal training. I was not, properly speaking, a plant biochemist or a botanist, because after all, I didn't have a degree in botany. I'd got my degree in the zoology department, even though I'd worked on plant materials. I was offered, approached with a couple of possibilities, all of which were, I thought, third-rate places to go to, in which I would have very little freedom to do with my own kind of thing. And my wife and I made the decision that we would hold out.
Were these others academic institutions? Or?
They were academic institutions, but one was to be somebody's research assistant at $1,500 a year. My wife was earning more than that teaching school. And we had saved a little bit of money. We weren't rich, but we could survive. And by then, prosperity had come back a little bit. That time, the war was on, business had picked up. My parents were even willing to help out if need be, which I didn't need, actually. And I got to talking with my friend Joe Fruton, who was at the Rockefeller working in Max Bergman's lab. Joe Fruton was a classmate of mine at Columbia. We didn't know each other that well in the first years because he had started out as a chemistry major right from the very beginning, so he was ahead of me in most of those classes. But I got to know him fairly well in my senior year. And then he went up to P&S to do his PhD in the biochemistry department with Hans Clark, while I stayed on the campus, and during that period we saw each other quite frequently. And in fact, my wife and I got married in 1934. We lived on 110th Street. And the following year, Joe married his wife, and they lived across the street from us. Then, of course, we saw each other a great deal. And when my wife and I went abroad in 38, they came along with us to spend the summer vacation and go to the same Congress that we were going. So we spent 6 weeks together, mm-hmm. traveling in France, Switzerland, during the summer of 1938. And I'd been back and forth to New York, and I had talked with Joe about the situation, and Joe said, look, let me talk to Bergman. And Bergman might be very interested in having you in the lab for a year or two, because you've had experience in purifying enzymes in Kalin's lab, and the physical chemical experience, and there might be an opening. So another fellowship. Initially for a year, but then stretched into 2 years, during which I got started in enzymology on the peptidases, and that story is told pretty well. And while Bergman was away in the summer vacations, I learned how to synthesize peptides from Joe Frutak. And made the first proline peptides and hydroxyproline peptides and a few other things. It was kind of fun. Which was very useful later on as well.
What was that group like at Rockefeller?
Well, that was a marvelous group.
Some pretty stellar people.
That was a pretty stellar group of people. Stan Moore was next door to me. Bill Stein was diagonally across the hall. Joe Fruton was downstairs. George Irving was across the hall. Paul Zamasnik was around the corner. There were about six or seven of us that were pretty good people. There was one Swiss with whom I overlapped for some months, named Max Brenner, who later became professor at Zurich, not in Zurich, in Basel, I'm sorry. And Klaus Hoffmann had just left the lab to go across the street to work with Davigno. Instead of going back to Switzerland, he stayed in the United States. Of course, later went to Pittsburgh, he's now retired. So it was a pretty distinguished group of people who made their marks in protein chemistry and enzymology. Rather remarkable people.
How would you compare that group at Rockefeller with the Cambridge group? Is there a contrast in their style and their...
The Rockefeller group was all trained in organic chemistry, essentially, with the exception of Paul Zamasnik, who was trained in biochemistry. The Cambridge group was more diverse in their biological and medical interests. I would say that they were equally distinguished groups, but went in different directions. The Rockefeller group was very much a chemical group. Zamasnik stayed more in the field of metabolism. I stayed in protein chemistry with a strong leaning on the organic side of it, even though it was part of it was devoted to biological problems, but so were the others. Fruton was organic and enzymological. Stein and Moore, you know. So that there was a different kind of bias. Kalin had some medical people with him, people dealing more with intermediary metabolism and medical problems. Straub was more the classical enzymologist, phenomenologist of getting at the proteins that did biological things. So it was different, but equally stellar, but in somewhat different bias. In fact, when I think of my own kind of background, it's a curious one, because starting out with a major interest in biology, and then working more on the biophysical side, and really on the physical side, and then going to Kalin, which was biochemical, but more with a very biological bias, and then ending up with 2 years of the Rockefeller with very much a strong organic chemical bias, in a certain sense, I became dilettante-ish, but I've always liked being a dilettante. I tried never to keep working on the same problem for more than a few years and drifted
yes.
as my fancy took me.